Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
So glad you tuned in to Radical Philosophy. I'm your host, Beth Matthews. Today on the program, we have part two of a two-part interview, and I'm speaking to Dr. Wendy Suter about Fuzzy Logic Principles, the Philosophy of Music. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here. It's very exciting.
So we were sort of up to you explaining about Fuzzy Logic Principles. Do you want to continue on with that question?
I will. So in my music study, I was referring to music analysis, and it mostly refers to harmony. It's mostly concerned with harmony, and that's actually, and as a composer, as I mentioned last time about talking about scores and that they've got all these encoded information, and as a composer, that's my job, is to put all that, encode all of that information and put it in the score. Harmony is only one of those elements. What I'm trying to say is it's actually only one of those elements, and there are other elements, like I said, like what instrument it is, like the particular tonal. If you hear the same piece of music played on a clarinet, it's going to sound different than if it was played on a trumpet. And it will have a different impact on you. So it's kind of like everything. In fact, everything that's encoded into that thing actually has an impact on, an effect on the way it impacts on the listener and what you're trying to convey. And as we mentioned previously as well, everything is, like there's actually no clear cut. Well, you can kind of go, this is clarinet and this is a trumpet. But if you're playing with electronics and you're going, well, I'm going to have an electronic clarinet and I'm going to have an electronic trumpet, you can actually merge those two together and you've kind of got a whole other thing. And that's my argument, is that actually fuzzy logic is a really good way to talk about music. It's actually to really talk about music as we experience it and as we compose it. And this is actually a radical notion, because most music analysis kind of talks about the composer and how fantastic they are or not and things, but leaves out so much of the information that actually affects us as listeners. And the thing about fuzzy logic is you can include as much or as little as you want to in the description, like the description of the music, and also because, like, what's loud and what's soft, and how many gradations are there between loud and soft. So fuzzy logic is based on the principle, is absolutely based on the principle of subjectivity, which I like, instead of going, there's actually no objective truth in this, because, well, there might be if you're clearly at the one true end, or there might be if you're clearly at the zero true end, but there's, like, where's the truth? Like the grains of sand moving, like when does that pile turn into that pile, the pile on the left hand turn into the pile on the right hand? That's just...
Yeah, that's right, because I like to listen to loud music, and if I've got the music on, I'm always, oh, that's too loud, turn it down. But that's my normal level. But obviously, it's probably most people's loud level. So, you know, it's sort of on an individual level as well. But when you were saying about that, it sort of made me think, like, sometimes, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but if a piece of music is written for, say, an 8-piece band, and then the same piece of music is written for a 12-piece band, they're just going to be miles apart, aren't they?
They could be.
I imagine they would be with that many more additional instruments.
So if there's additional instruments, I think, because I'm getting very technical in my thinking, going, well, if you've got two trumpets and you just add on another four trumpets, you're still going to have a very loud trumpet sound. So it will be different to a degree, but it would be really different if the extra four instruments, say a bass drum, like you've got your trumpet and then you've got a bass drum and then you've got a harp and then you've got a thinking xylophone, something. So they would, if you've got really different sounds, which, and for me, sound, I think for me as a composer, sound is a really driving force in my music. That's so.
Well, that's right too. And one example I thought of one favourite, you know, ever since I was quite young, I've loved Tubular Bells. And then in Melbourne, it was a performance of it, so I had to go and see it. But I sort of, just listening to it for so many years, I had this image in my mind of most of the music being the bells, but when I got there and I saw it, it wasn't. And it was almost like I thought, oh, I was sort of almost disappointed. I mean, it was a thrill to hear it, but I was disappointed because there was this image that I sort of built up over the years and then it wasn't right.
Yes, I can relate to that. Actually, I had a similar experience, so that's right. It's the bells, because at the time that was extraordinary.
Mm.
And it's, I suppose. And yes, it is. So that's what kind of lasts with you. That's really interesting about what it is that lasts from your experience of listening to something. Not just the emotion, but actually the auditory experience as well. Mm. So that was my idea. So this was part of my, and I think the thing, so, and I mentioned that I'd studied statistics, and a lot of that's based on probability theory. And I have always, ever since the Women's Liberation talks in Form 6 maths, where we were first started being taught probability theory, I'm going, this does not make sense. Like, I can sort of understand it, but it just did not compute. It doesn't fit with the way that I want to think about things. And I think that's... And the thing about probability theory, it's really about predicting it's one way of dealing with uncertainty. Uncertainty is a favourite word in fuzzy logic. It's one way of dealing with uncertainty about, if you toss a coin, is it going to be heads or tails? Well, it's probability of a half that will. So that's kind of like predicting the future. Or if you got a lucky dip of coins and you're going, am I going to pick out a head or a tail, when you actually know how many coins are in the bag and stuff, it's kind of going, well, there's a 50% chance you'll probably pick out a coin and it will be a head. You're sort of like, yes, but that's not the only, like, there's other ways of thinking about things. And when you talk about trying to do calculations where you're actually, going around a bit in a circle. So fuzzy logic was invented by Professor Zadeh as an alternative way of doing AI, doing artificial intelligence. So these days we talk about AI, but they're over right through the 20th century, even from early on in the 20th century, men generally have been concerned with trying to automate things and basically it's been based on probability theory of try and building computers and machines that will operate like the human brain. So the idea of having brain cells, neurons that connect up with each other and somehow thoughts flow and some result comes out at the other end. Instead, this idea of using fuzzy logic, and it's all supposed to be objective because it's all about probabilities and stuff like that, so it just all happens. We forget mankind and womankind. With fuzzy logic was the idea, and that's why I like the idea of subjectivity, because But it was the idea about problem solving. Like, what does the brain do? It thinks things and it solves problems. That's what we're actually trying to do. That's what we're trying to do, is to get it to solve problems. And to solve a problem, you don't need to know every single thing in the whole world. The thing about this whole thing about emulating neurons in the brain was that you had to have like millions of them so as they could have everything in the whole world in there. You don't need to know everything in the whole world. And the principal example of that is like if you're driving down a street, there's a lot of things going on, but generally as a human being, I was thinking, should I say woman? But anyway, as a human being, you kind of go, you don't really need to pay attention to all the parked cars. You're probably paying attention if you see a kid on the footpath going like, is it about to jump out? Or is there a car coming down the other way and how much space is there? But you're not individually concentrating on each parked car. You're only concentrating on the information that you need at that precise moment to decide what to do, to decide what to do next. And so so this whole concept of using fuzzy principles to generate computer programs was like you just don't need to know everything. You only need to know the important things. And I think that's really what, going back to the tubular bells, like that's what's important when you're listening is the tubular bells. You don't really listen to the strings and the other bits and pieces that are there. And that's why I think fuzzy logic, applying that to the idea of listening to music, is a really, and the analysis of music is actually a really fabulous idea. That's
now, when I first got in touch with you about the interview, I thought we could actually play some of your music, but given that the copyright with podcasts has gone the way it has, unfortunately we can't. So I'm going to ask you a really difficult question. Can you describe your music?
Can my music is, I keep on being surprised when people listen to their music and they actually find it to be quite moving. They tell me they get goosebumps and things like that, and I'm going, I think I just do what I'm being taught because that's what I'm used to doing. Describing my music, as I said, I'm really interested in sound. I'm really interested in sound, the quality of sound, and that is a major reason that I'm really interested in electronic music, because there's such a huge, like you've just got every sound in the whole world that you can play with and manipulate. And you can make them up and you can just do anything. So I have composed music using my voice and written text for that, and which I'm trying to think. It is hard to describe my music. So it's not conventional. A number of people, unless they really listen to it with an open mind, and I know that there are some people that do that, kind of go, some of them go, I don't understand this music. This isn't very helpful, is it? So harmony is not a strong point, and that's really in conventional art music and conventional just about every other music in the Western world. Harmony is still the dominant thing that everybody talks about. I'm really interested in the quality of sound. I'm really interested in how those sounds relate to each other. I have an idea that it's about putting sounds together that are going to try and convey an idea, and that's not new in music. The principal idea that we all live with is emotion, like we've talked about, but other people, it's really interesting when people talk about church music, for example, they go, oh, this is to celebrate the glory of God. And yet I feel like at the bottom of that is, that's the emotion. Like people actually want to do that because it makes them feel in a particular way.
I think there's lots of atheists that really like church music as well.
Yes. Well, that's right. Well, there's a lot to like in church music. There's a lot to like in all sorts of music. But I think it's an interesting question because that is like why they, you know, why they like it. Does it sound ethereal? Like, is it because it sounds ethereal, which a lot of old, I'm going to say medieval church music sounds really ethereal. But like music's been written for whole other things to celebrate the arrival of the Queen. So it's a bit like I feel like I'm aware that it's a bit circular. But why is it that we want to celebrate the arrival of the Queen? Is it, you know, like there's somewhere it still comes back on what some level? I feel like it still comes back to the emotional thing, although I do.
Can be emotional, could be a sign of respect too.
That's,
you know, I mean, you know, it'd be good to have your own little theme tune wherever you go. You could play that, and it's like, oh, look, Beth's coming. There's your theme tune.
That's right. Well, yeah, that's true. Okay, so that's a whole other. That's a whole other thing. It's like a ringtone, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Ah, oh, cheapens it saying ringtone. But look, one question. Look, it absolutely fascinates me is Marlowe Moss, which we know. Anybody at home, you can Google her. Now, she was an artist that created artworks that mainly composed of geometrical shapes that appear to be randomly arranged on canvas. Now, when I listen to your music, which I really like, I can draw a parallel between your music and Moss's artwork. What do you think of that?
What do I think of that? I'm going to think Grace Crowley instead. Who's
okay, yeah. And why is that?
So I went to an exhibition of women's art at the Heidi Gallery up in Heidelberg, and I saw there is hardly any of Grace Crowley's work still in existence. For some reason it's all been destroyed. I think she just... been looking her up so I could try and talk about her knowledgeably. And I went to this exhibition, so she was like Marlowe Moss, whom I'd actually never heard of until now, is so she took the idea of geometric shapes, would put them on a piece of paper and decide which ones to leave there and which ones to take away and which ones to actually put on the paper. And I will say I'm actually really fascinated by her process. So she's an Australian artist. She came from Sydney and about 1940 50 60, and that's where I first saw about the thing of geometric shapes. One of the questions that has really fascinated me is that I actually really like sculpture as an art form, and sometimes I wish I'd been a sculptor instead. So I've got this thing about like sculpting in sort of, and a quote from Michelangelo that I read when he said, "I see the angel in the marble, it's my job to get it out." Yes, more or less. And I'm kind of really like that. I find that really inspirational in that way, and comes back to the sculpture idea. Especially with a lot of modern art sculpture like Grace, is that it feels like people seems, looking at it, like people just jam two things together and suddenly it turns into something that I can actually look at and appreciate. And it's been my question of, God, can you actually do that with two sounds? Or, and most people go, no, you can't, that just sounds like noise. That's just... And so then I think as time passes and I've realised probably the sculptor went out and actually found two pieces of things that they thought fitted together. They probably didn't just randomly go, oh, that's a can of Coke and that's a brown paper bag. I'll just put them together. But you see, even if you did that, you can still find it. You can still kind of, if you're me, you can still see a meaning in those. You can find something that joins them together. Whereas for some reason we think about music very differently, and traditionally the German philosophers have thought about music very, very differently than any other art form, and it's supposedly, according to Schopenhauer, it's the highest art form in the whole known universe. And it's become very mystical. So even though I'm struggling at the moment to think about how to describe my music without actually being able to example it, it's one of the things of going, I really want to undo the mysticism. It's just another art form, like you get a paintbrush and a paint thing and you two things out of the gutter or whatever it is you do, and you can somehow make music. And we've just got this received, all this wisdom about, and especially in the West, we've got such four square music that's always either in 4/4 or waltz or 3/4. So either straight kind of marching dance music or waltz music. And this thing about harmony, that music has to finish in a particular way. And how do you know when it's finished? Because it slows down and it does, like, there's all these conventions. And if music, my music doesn't do that, it does some of those things. But how do you actually make a piece of music feel finished or unfinished? That there's actually more, there's actually could be more to come. Do you want that to happen? And I guess that's what I like to actually generally finish, is on an upbeat thing, except the music I actually made from my spoken word. That was actually about the refugees and about the children overboard thing from John Howard. That's...
Oh, yeah, yeah. So is there anything else you'd like to add that we haven't already covered?
I feel like I've been talking a lot. I'm not... That's not my music. Sorry,
it's all right. I can edit that out. Yes.
Yes. Is there anything else? I actually think it's really important. I think because in the composition tradition that I was taught composition in, and also especially in the electronic music world, but also because of being taught avant-garde techniques, I suppose I didn't even get there. So I would describe my music tends to be more avant-garde. It often challenges people because it doesn't do the traditional things very much. Is that we're kind of taught to ignore the audience, which is like just about the opposite end to what I'm concerned about. Is like, I actually want my music to speak to, I actually want my music to try and communicate something. And it could be just a technical idea, like, I love the sound of this water flowing. I had a lovely day down at the Gellibrand River once with my microphone and my cassette recorder, sitting there just recording the water going past these rocks while I sat there and had a picnic. I'm going, what a good excuse to get out into nature for the day. It's just fabulous. So that's of kind of going, like, music is a form of communication. It's not just this ethereal thing that transports you places or something, but it's actually, and that as composers, we are art music composers, we're actually trying to communicate something. And it's really complicated because these days, especially these days, as life progresses and technology progresses, so few people actually play music. We've all become consumers rather than actually producers, whether it's producers of playing other people's music, you know, like scores, or making your own music. And I think that's a really sad thing, and kind of it's part of the communication thing of kind of like, and that art music in particular has become so divorced from everyday life, whereas in other cultures music is a really important, it's an important part of everyday life for rituals and observances and feast days and things like that. That's starts to get into a whole other thing, but that's all part of it. It's really important for music, for us to remember that music is a means of communicating, and how do we do that?
And especially to look, I'm very fond of music, and I wanted to be able to play and compose music when I was quite young, but so I took music as a subject, but I didn't do very well at it at all. And being dyslexic, I couldn't read music. But just recently in the last few years, there's something called... I never thought that I could play music, but there's something called the Suzuki method. Yes. Basically, you do something over and over and over and over again until you remember it. And I've started playing music. And fantastic. It's just wonderful to be able to do that. I think that music was taught in a very rigid form when I was young. And now it's sort of a bit of a free-for-all, which is good, because a lot of people who couldn't sort of grasp onto that concept can actually do that now. So now that I'm starting to play music, I might even think about composing something. Well, you never know that you've got a talent until you really give it a go, do you?
That's right. And I think that's true. I think it's true. The Suzuki method is a fabulous teaching method. I wish I had learnt, because that was the learnt that way, because that was the thing about my father going, well, you have to learn to play music properly, was actually about learning to read. I mean, I'd already learnt to read music a bit from playing the recorder, but like seriously learning to read it and how to manage all of that stuff. And it's a whole other skill that I guess I've just become used to. But even now I'm thinking about when I was explaining something else about music to another friend, and about the note names, and about when if you're just saying the note names off the dots on the page, there's a whole other skill. She pointed out to me that you actually have to be able to say the alphabet backwards. And I'm going, that's why I have such difficulty doing this particular part, because I haven't learned how to say the alphabet backwards. And it's like there's a whole – these things, like other things. I read a book by a blind woman about her experience of living with blindness, and she said, I go out my front door and I can hear four different birds singing. Most other people that are sighted, they go out the door, they go, oh, the birds are singing. And I would go, I want to be able to distinguish sound like that. These are kinds of tasks that I've set myself about sound, and how do you distinguish things from each other. And so you've made a really good point, because it's a very technical thing, and we all have different abilities. My niece really struggled with piano music because she couldn't be bothered reading it. Like, she would just sit there and want to play. That's just – reading's boring. Why would I do that? I just want to play.
Oh, thanks for saying that, and thanks so much for coming onto the program today.
It's my pleasure. It's wonderful to talk about these things.
It is, and I've been speaking with Dr. Wendy Suter about fuzzy logic principles. And that's all we have time for today. Hope you've enjoyed the program, and do tune in next month.